This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. About 2 years ago, Facebook bought the photo-sharing app Instagram for somewhere around $1 billion. Critics and media watchers balked at the price and wondered if Facebook would get its money's worth. Last week, Mark Zuckerberg announced an even higher-priced acquisition, buying the virtual reality company Oculus VR for $2 billion. This may be the first time that non-gamers are hearing about the Oculus Rift. Jamin Warren, founder of Killscreen, a video game culture magazine, is with us to explain why Facebook has put so much stock in virtual reality. Jamin, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Listeners who may have heard about this acquisition may not know much about Oculus Rift itself. So can you describe, you know, how you use it, what it looks like?
Sure. So the Oculus Rift device is a virtual reality headset. It's very, very light. And probably people had some experience with virtual reality in the 90s. At the time, the technology wasn't really there to create the types of experiences that you can create now. But it was developed by a teenager from Southern California named Palmer Luckey, who had put together some off-the-part shelves to create a virtual reality system sort of from scratch. He took that to Kickstarter, raised about $2.5 million, which then paved the way for creating a company, took on some VC investment from some heavy hitters in the Valley, and that kind of paved the way for an acquisition. Although I don't think anyone thought it was going to happen quite so quickly.
Have you ever tried one on? How do you do it?
I have. It's pretty easy. I mean, it's like putting on a pair of, if you've ever gone scuba diving or something like that, it's roughly about the same experience. You strap it to your head, and then you have to bring your own headphones. So there aren't any headphones that are attached to it.
What's the experience like once you put this headset on?
I was, it's funny. I was admittedly very skeptical before I tried it out, simply because, I, like many people, had kind of tried VR in the 90s when I was a kid. And, it's really, really cool. I mean, it's rare that I try a new piece of technology that feels like it's going to fundamentally alter the way that I experience media. But that certainly is the case with the Oculus. For anyone who's tried it, I mean, it recreates certain types of experiences that I think would be very, very hard to capture, like flying, for example. I mean, that's like a pretty simple one that people have dreamed about, which it just feels so much more realistic with an Oculus Rift headset. It's a pretty amazing device.
Wow. Well, Facebook's purchase of Oculus VR, that's the company behind the Rift, has sparked an ugly backlash. What's behind that?
Sure. Well, I think there's two different sides to it. One is from the Kickstarter backers. The Kickstarter, part of the narrative of Kickstarter is that you go there because, traditional funding sources aren't available to you. And creators and founders, they sell this vision that we really need your help, right? And the end outcome of this is that the $2.5 million that went into the company benefits the VC and the investors who put money in later, not the original Kickstarter backers. Now, all the Kickstarter people sign up for is to get a virtual reality headset, the dev kit, which has been available for sale for the past year. But I think there's this sense that the money that went in wasn't necessarily for this big $2 billion exit. The other sentiment of the backlash comes from, I think, from gamers who, for a long time, I think, and this is a longer, sort of a longer conversation, but, gamers are often treated as being, backwater or not interested in the future of technology. And there's a sense that sort of the party's over, specifically for independent game designers who maybe were pinning their hopes to it. So, because Facebook is this huge, huge Fortune 500 company. There's this sense that this scrappy little upstart was kind of was smothered in its infancy. I don't necessarily see it that way, but that's where the backlash is coming from.
Well, it is interesting. One of the headlines of your articles is, "Are gamers ready to share the Oculus Rift as if it were theirs?"
Well, some of it comes from the founder, Palmer Luckey, himself. We had the fortune of having Palmer at our conference last year, and he's been very vocal about the fact that he built this device to play games, and games primarily, because he feels like, games are this hotbed of emerging technology. And so I think in the way that, it was pitched initially was mostly for games, and a lot of the most fervent developers for it were game developers. And so now there's going to be, and if you look at Mark Zuckerberg's language, there's going to be this opening up of what VR, particularly the Oculus Rift, is for, whether it's for advertisers or it's for the tourism industry or film or music or whatever it might be. It's kind of like if you're the first person to the party, you like being, you like claiming that you were there first, and then when everyone else gets to have the same thing that you have, all of a sudden your initial fervor somehow seems less special than it once used to. It's a pretty, it's a human, understandably human reaction.
The Oculus Rift is certainly not yet a mass market item, but you mentioned there are these dev kits, development kits that people are using. What are some of the ways that the Oculus Rift has been used besides gaming?
Yeah, I've seen a couple amazing prototypes. I know from the world of games, I tried a space fighting game called Eve Valkyrie, which is amazing. I've never operated something that felt like it was in 3D space. There was a Canadian musician who used it to record a song. You basically show up in the room, you put on the headset, and he sits down at a camera, and then you can rotate and look all the way around stage. I mean, Chris Milk, the director, has used it to record Beck, the musician, Beck, live on stage. So you can pop on an Oculus Rift headset and watch Beck play. It's as if you're right there next to him. There's a lot of potential here. Tourism is one that, you know, I think I'm very excited about. I'm never going to climb Mount Everest, but it's possible for me to maybe experience that by proxy. Or, you know, I'm not going to have courtside seats to the Final Four, but, you know, the Oculus Rift does open the possibility for me to experience those things by proxy, and a very convincing proxy at that.
Well, any idea of how Mark Zuckerberg and a social network like Facebook would use it?
Yeah, I think that's the big question that everyone has. I mean, admittedly, there are some concerns there. Facebook doesn't have a track record with hardware. This is a hardware device. Facebook's business model is advertising supported. Right now, you know, the Oculus Rift was chiefly designed for people to sell experiences. I think what it reflects is Oculus fits into, I think, a larger philosophical framework for Facebook. Facebook wants to be the center of your communication world. They want to control all the different ways that you interact with the outside world. And I think that they're looking at virtual reality the same way that someone might have looked at, say, smartphones, say, 10, 15 years ago. I don't think that the Oculus Rift is going to be the only virtual reality device, but Facebook wants to jump to the head of the line and start looking for ways to integrate it into their existing package, whether it's with Instagram or with Facebook or with WhatsApp or whatever that might be. This might ostensibly be one of the delivery mechanisms for Facebook products, the same way that Facebook develops things for mobile. So, you know, time will tell. It's certainly a speculative investment at some level, but Facebook is, it was a mostly stock deal, so they're not putting a lot of cash up front to purchase the company. And, you know, obviously Facebook has been on quite a buying spree over the past 12 to 18 months.
Jamin Warren is with us. He's founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen, a video game culture magazine and website. Is this strategic on Facebook's part? Are they trying to get an upper hand or maybe trying to gain a little bit of an edge on wearable technology like Google Glass, that sort of thing?
So one of the interesting things about the Oculus is that, you know, in terms of a piece of technology, there are some breakthroughs with existing pieces and existing patents, but it's not like what Facebook is buying is something like Apple, for example. They own, you know, patents for slide to refresh and multi-touch, and obviously have been embroiled in big lawsuits about new technologies like with Samsung, et cetera. That's not the case with Oculus. And so I think this deal, what it represents is two things. I think one is that the Oculus Rift, there's going to be competition in that space, and I think Oculus certainly knows that. And the flip side is that Facebook wants to, you know, remain in the vanguard of what's cool, new, and interesting. And, you know, in some ways they get more PR out of these acquisitions than they do when they roll out new incremental updates to the news feed, for example. So it might be a weird way to spend, you know, $2 billion, but given that it was leveraged mostly by stock, not by cash up front, yeah, I think you could look at it as a way that Facebook wants to be ahead of the curve and maybe gobble up Oculus before somebody else does, an Apple, a Microsoft, or a Google.
Jamin Warren, founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen. That's a video game culture magazine and website. Thank you very much for your time.
Of course, anytime.
It's opening day for the Red Sox as they take on the Baltimore Orioles. Red Sox Nation is hoping that this year's roster will bring them to the World Series once again. But how much can we really predict at this point in the season? Is it really all about the numbers? Up next, a statistician who worked with the Mets explains why the Moneyball theory is overhyped. Stay with us for that story. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. As unlikely as it sounds, analyzing baseball statistics became Hollywood entertainment in the 2011 film Moneyball.
People are overlooked for a variety of biased reasons and perceived flaws. Age, appearance, personality. using stats the way we read them, will find value in players that nobody else can see. Like An Island of Misfit Toys.
That film, based on the book of the same name, tells the story of the Oakland A's visionary manager, Billy Bean, and his quest to build a winning team on a shoestring budget. Bean enlisted a Yale grad who analyzed stats using a data and evidence-based method called sabermetrics. By looking at undervalued statistics like on-base or slugging percentage rather than more popular stats like batting averages, the team acquired quality overlooked players on the cheap. In that 2002 season, the A's won 20 games in a row, an American League record, and took their division, all on a fraction of the payroll for powerhouse teams like the Yankees or the Red Sox. Billy Bean's success ignited a moneyball trend among the majors. Teams hired mathematicians and analysts to wade through the numbers and find baseball players who deliver the best bang for the smallest buck. Benjamin Bomber is one of those post-moneyball hires. He worked for the New York Mets for 8 years and is now visiting assistant professor at Smith College. He's also co-author of the book, The Sabermetric Revolution. And Benjamin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
Where did this term sabermetrics come from?
So this comes from, it's an acronym for the Society for American Baseball Research, so that's S-A-B-R, and I believe Bill James coined the term. A lot of people call him the godfather of sabermetrics, and I think it's appropriate. He was writing about this with a volume and intensity and insightfulness that exceeded pretty much everything that we had seen prior to that. So in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, Bill James was a huge motivator of the ideas behind sabermetrics and the popularization of it.
Oh, so gone are the images of the saber-toothed tiger somehow digging
That's
into...
That's right, yeah, completely unrelated, yep.
Why does baseball lend itself so easily to in-depth statistical analysis? For example, why didn't sabermetrics start in basketball?
Well, it's a good question, and I think the simplest way to think about that is just the fact that the action in baseball is very discrete. So everything seems to take place for the most part in these very easy to categorize chunks. So, you know exactly who the batter is, you know exactly who the pitcher is, you know exactly who all the nine fielders on the field are. And in general, most of the time, you know exactly what happened. You know if it was a single, you know if it was a ground out, you know if it was a fly out. And, you know, in sports like basketball or soccer, the action is just so much more complicated and intertwined. And so when you have this action that's very easy to categorize, people record statistics. And then once you have those statistics, you start analyzing them. And it's easy to think about the contributions that the batter is making in relation to like what the pitcher is doing much more easily than it is in some of these other sports.
Mm-hmm. It was Michael Lewis's book, Moneyball, that made many of us aware of sabermetrics and how it was used by the 2002 Oakland Athletics. Were the Oakland A's really the first team to use these kind of undervalued stats?
Probably not. It's hard to say because teams, except for the A's in the case of Moneyball, are generally not so forthcoming about what it is that they're actually doing as far as sabermetrics goes. But we know that, there was a guy named Craig Wright who worked for the Texas Rangers before that, and we know that Sandy Alderson, who was Billy Bean's predecessor who hired him, was actively engaged with sabermetrics before the Billy Bean era. So, yeah. So other teams were certainly doing this before the A's.
All right. This brings us, however, to the accuracy of Moneyball. Your book attempts to set the record straight on what really happened. What were some of Moneyball's fabrications as far as you're concerned?
Well, there's a number of, facts that they get incorrect. But I think the big picture is just that Moneyball told the story this David and Goliath story where David is able to slay Goliath because he's smarter, essentially. And, when you actually go back and do the accounting for that season, for the 2002 A's, the contributions that were made by the players who were acquired for their sabermetric virtue were relatively small in relation to the contribution of the players made who were already there and who were acquired by virtue of their traditional scouting acumen. So Eric Chavez, Miguel Tejada, Barry Zito, Mark Mulder, Tim Hudson, these are bit players in Moneyball, the book and the movie, and they probably contributed something like 2/3 of the wins that the A's had that year.
I guess it makes for a better story, however, when you have Davey and Goliath.
Certainly, certainly it does. And it was a great story, there's no question.
In the book, in your book, you write about how teams hired more statisticians after Moneyball, not necessarily because they were positive that it worked, but they didn't want to be left behind. So was Sabermetrics overhyped?
Well, I think Moneyball was overhyped. And I think that the notion that there are easy answers to difficult questions just by looking at statistics is a little bit overhyped. You know, so if you saw Moneyball and you got the impression that, you know, oh, there's like a couple of smart guys and they do these calculations and all of a sudden like we understand how baseball works, you know, it's really not the case. Statistics is difficult, and a lot of what comes out of it are very subtle, kind of nuanced interpretations. And sometimes I think that gets lost a little bit.
There are many ways to scout a baseball player, and I'm guessing the extremes might be on the one end purely statistical. You know, you pore over the numbers, you use logic to choose the player with the best stats. The other end of the spectrum is that gut instinct, you know, just sensing something in a player that cannot be described. Are there things that statistics cannot measure, Benjamin?
I think there's definitely things that statistics don't measure. Can they measure it? I don't know. Maybe that's a question for a psychologist. But I think it's certainly easy to see things that we currently do not capture, right? Like if you think about scouting a high school baseball player, they're probably facing pitchers who throw 80 to 85 miles an hour. And, you know, let's say you find a player who's just crushing that type of pitching. Does that mean that that player is going to be able to hit a 95 mile an hour fastball? You know, that question is hard to answer, and it has to do with his strength and coordination and reflexes and, you know, determination and how his body is going to change in the future. There's all these questions that go into it, and certainly statistics is not capturing any of that.
We're speaking with Benjamin Balmer about Sabermetrics, the Moneyball model, for lack of a better word. He's written a new book about Sabermetrics, and he also served as a statistical analyst in the world of Major League Baseball. Benjamin, you worked for the New York Mets for 8 years as a statistical analyst and started in 2004. Now, this was just a year after the book Moneyball was published. Do you think that your hiring had anything to do with release of the book?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been told that it has. Jim Duquette, who was the GM of the Mets at the time, the person that hired me, you know, he'd been reading Bill James for years, you know, long before Moneyball. And I think what Moneyball provided was the impetus for a lot of people to really get in the game here. And I think the Mets, like a lot of other teams in the years after that, you know, really found that they wanted someone to do this kind of job, and I was lucky enough to be that person for the Mets.
And wonder what a typical day consisted of for you, you know, going out watching the guys in the field or just sitting there crunching numbers?
Mostly the latter. A typical day was in the office. For me, it meant, you know, database programming and web programming and, yeah, crunching numbers, having meetings, you know, talking to other people in the front office, talking to the coaches occasionally. And then if we were home, you'd stay for the game and watch the game. And, you know, that was certainly the more fun part.
Well, in Moneyball, it was Jonah Hill playing a Yale grad. What kind of education would one need to be hired as a sabermetrician?
Well, it's another good question. And, you know, that has changed a lot in the last 10 to 15 years. I had a master's in applied math at the time. And, you know, now you're seeing people coming out of schools with PhDs getting hired by clubs. So it is much more difficult and much more competitive, certainly, than it used to be.
Well, we are in Red Sox country right here, and the Moneyball story does briefly involve the Red Sox and Theo Epstein, former general manager's embrace of the Moneyball method. Can you explain, tell us a little bit about how that worked for the Red Sox?
Well, so the Red Sox were, one of the early adopters, and I think what separated the Red Sox in some ways from teams like the A's is that they actually had money. So not only did they have the intellectual advantage, if you will, but they also had the financial advantage. And, you know, very clearly that has paid dividends for them.
And I think the Red Sox, at least in the movie, if I'm remembering things correctly, wanted to hire Billy Beane, but he didn't take the offer.
That's correct, yeah. He apparently they had a deal, and Billy Beane backed out at the last minute. You know, the important thing for the Red Sox was that they found someone who, you know, just as Billy Beane was completely on board with sabermetrics. And, you know, that really matters. Having someone at the top who is behind that kind of thinking really makes a huge difference in getting everyone else involved. And the Red Sox have certainly been successful doing that.
Benjamin Balmer, he's assistant professor of mathematics and statistics at Smith College. He and co-author Andrew Zimbalist Jr., professor of economics at Smith, wrote the book The Sabermetric Revolution. For more information on the book, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Well, stick around for more Word of Mouth. Producer Zach Nugent has been scouring record stores for the best new music offerings. When we continue, a little sample of his essential playlist. But first, the news. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Time for spring cleaning is right around the corner, and we at Word of Mouth encourage you to look beyond the dusty closets and cluttered drawers to that little device sitting on your counter. When was the last time you cleaned out your iPod? Some new music may be just what you need to put the winter behind you. Here to help is producer Zach Nugent in a segment we're calling The Audio Orchard, a hand-picked playlist of his favorite new songs.
I'm here to admit I'm a new music junkie. In fact, my ideal Saturday night is scouring music blogs in search of a new song or band I find interesting. From indie buzz bands to opera singers, nothing's off limits. And every month I'll make a playlist of my findings. The first song in this month's playlist is called Water Fountain by the band Toon Yards. No water in the water fountain. No side on the sidewalk. If you say, oh yeah, what you doing there? Nothing much to do when you're going nowhere. Woo-ha, woo-ha, gotcha. We're gonna get the water from your house. Toon Yards is the project of a woman named Meryl Garbus. She grew up in New England, went to Smith College, and for a short period was a puppeteer for the Sandglass Theater in Vermont. Her music is all about rhythm. She plays the drums and makes loops, and then builds her songs on top of the loops by layering her voice and various percussion and a bass or a ukulele line. And after enough layers, it's really fun to listen to. Water Fountain is the first single off her much-anticipated new album called Nicky Knack, which comes out in May. The next song on my playlist is called Seasons, Waiting on You, by the band Future Islands. Future Islands' new album, Singles, came out this month, and it's getting a ton of buzz for a couple reasons. One, it's a great album. Pitchfork gave it an 8 out of 10. And two, their performance on The Late Show with David Letterman went super viral. Dave was practically giddy after the performance.
Oh, buddy, come on! Hey, thank you very much. Nice going. How about that? I'll take all of that you got. Future Island! That was wonderful!
If you haven't seen the performance, it's lead singer Samuel Herring, who looks more like a high school English teacher than a rock star, and he's doing this hypnotic kind of dance, and he's
pounding his chest and he's growling into the microphone. And that sounds strange, and it is strange, but it's incredibly, incredibly engaging. And the next song on my playlist is from New England's own Ray LaMontagne, and it's called Supernova. So you and me, we've been hanging out now ever since we were kids, just kicking around this town. So you know me and I don't back down. I know what I want, I think I found it. I want you. So after his last album, which was highly successful, LaMontagne went into a crippling depression and he almost quit the music business altogether. He's a notoriously private guy and he's just not really into the whole fame thing. But fortunately for us, he worked through his issues and he teamed up with Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys for this new album. It's called Supernova and it will be out in May. At the end of every month, I'll be creating an Audio Orchard playlist, which means I'm always on the lookout for fresh new music. And I want suggestions from you. Do you have a favorite new band or a new song you can't stop listening to? Let me know at our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio.
Three ripe picks there from producer Zach Nugent's Audio Orchard playlist for March. To hear all 12 songs on the playlist, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A lot of kids go through a dinosaur phase, begging parents to buy anything associated with the T-Rex. The Tyrannosaurus, the Stegosaurus, and Triceratops have a kind of celebrity status among the dino-crazed, appearing to be fixed and scaly bridges to the ancient past. The truth is not so static. For nearly three centuries, an ever-growing fossil record and scientific progress revealed the importance of a number of unsung species that may have far more to tell us about ancient biology than our popular paleo crushes. Brian Sweetek is author of My Beloved Brontosaurus. It's a book about the history of paleontology and the transformation of dinosaurs in popular imagination. We found his recent article, T-Rex Might Be the Thing with Feathers, on the science website Nautilus. Brian, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
How did the celebrity species come to dominate our image of the dinosaur?
Right now, they're famous because they're famous. They have a kind of cultural momentum that just can't be beat, partially because of their names. You know, you think of Tyrannosaurus Rex. There's no better name in all of science, as far as I'm concerned. It's absolutely perfect. So much so that when the legs of this dinosaur were being erected at the American Museum of Natural History in 1906, the New York Times already called it the prize fighter of antiquity, and it was going to be, you know, the biggest, meanest, most fierce dinosaur that there ever was, and it still kind of holds that status in our imagination. Where that came from is it just got there first. During the great bone rush of the late 1800s and sort of the following expeditions in the early 1900s, fossil hunters went out to the American West. They're getting complete skeletons. They're bringing them back to museums in the East, museums in Pittsburgh and New York City and Chicago and Philadelphia, and those dinosaurs kind of occupied that museum place first, and they got into the newspaper. People were very excited. No one had ever seen animals like this before. But, you know, that was really only the beginning of paleontology in America. So all these dinosaurs that came after, and often many dinosaurs that were very significant to changing understanding of their biology, kind of got overshadowed by these celebrity species that just happened to be the most spectacular specimens that were found first.
So it was tough to look beyond these kind of poster children or these early finds. What then gets lost, Brian, when we
we don't go beyond those celebrity species?
Well, for one thing, how much there's left to find. You know, many people that I've spoken to during my talks and everything, they think most dinosaurs are already discovered, that we've found most of what there is to find. We're just kind of getting the fine print down at this point. And that's absolutely not true at all. Most dinosaurs are as yet undiscovered. There's about 500 genera that have been named so far, and it's estimated that there are over 1,800 genera during the sort of the heyday of the dinosaurs during their Mesozoic reign. So really, we're not even close to even finding all of them yet, much less understanding them. But beyond that, many of the species that we're finding now are just incredibly weird. They preserve structures that might not be found in other dinosaurs, like feathers. You know, many of these new dinosaurs coming out of China, covered in feathers, changing our perception of these animals' biology, how they insulated themselves, what colors they might have been, how feathers and birds evolved, because birds are modern dinosaurs after all. So really, the most important stuff, the most exciting aspects, I think, about understanding how these animals lived are coming from sort of unsung and little-known dinosaurs.
How about how the dinosaurs that we have in our imagination have changed? Let's look at Tyrannosaurus rex. It was first named around the turn of the 20th century. Now, what has changed since our first conception of the T-Rex until today?
First conception of Tyrannosaurus was as this kind of lumbering, almost Godzilla pose animal. I mean, Godzilla wasn't invented yet, but you know, this lumbering, pot-bellied carnivore that might have even been too big to actively hunt. Some paleontologists saw it as, you know, this scavenger, this Cretaceous cleanup crew, just munching on whatever it could find. Now it's much closer to the animal that you see in the Jurassic Park film, something that's very active, very lithe, very agile. Might have been social in some ways, and one of the coolest things is that is probably covered in some kind of feathery fuzz, some kind of proto-feather. We know there's some closely related tyrannosaurs that were found with feathers. And also just sort of the evolutionary logic at looking, where feathers exist in the dinosaur evolutionary tree. So the animal that it is now, this sort of gigantic carnivorous roadrunner, is quite different from the sort of tottering scavenger it was first envisioned as. Mm.
That movie Jurassic Park really embedded the images of dinosaurs in most of our minds. How did it change the place of the dinosaur in the public imagination?
Well, it was really a revitalization of dinosaurs in a way. This was coming at the end of a period in paleontology called the Dinosaur Renaissance, where dinosaurs were really being reinvented. I mean, previously they were seen as slow, stupid, swamp-dwelling, relatively drab, basically sort of behaviorally and otherwise like just big lizards, that they're these cold-blooded animals that, couldn't be bothered to get out of the swamp, and they didn't do anything except eat and breed. Jurassic Park really was a way to use Hollywood special effects to bring the best science of the time to the public, to really reinvigorate dinosaurs as they've never been seen before. Instead of those sort of lumbering, stupid animals, you had highly intelligent, active, social animals acting in a new way. And even though Jurassic Park is now 20 years old and dinosaurs have continued to change since then, it still is this major milestone in changing the public perception of what a dinosaur was. It really set the stage for, my generation and I think continuing generations' image of what a dinosaur is.
Your book is titled My Beloved Brontosaurus, and you made the Brontosaurus, which we now know never actually existed, the kind of the centerpiece of your book. Now, why?
Well, because it was an excellent sort of baseline to gauge just how much dinosaurs have changed. I mean, I met Brontosaurus, this dinosaur that's now defunct. It actually had been defunct since 1906, except no one really cared to put that into museums.
Are you kidding?
Yes.
I grew up thinking there was a Brontosaurus.
Yeah, a paleontologist by the name of Elmer Riggs in 1906, he figured out that Apatosaurus and Brontosaurus were the same dinosaur. And because Apatosaurus had been named first by about, 2 years, it had priority as the name. So that, Apatosaurus became the proper name for the animal. But museums, for whatever reason, they just didn't go with the change. They kept Brontosaurus, in their museum galleries and in their books. And it kind of became a popular shorthand. Paleontologists in their books would often talk about Brontosaurus just because they knew the public knew that dinosaur best. They didn't want to sort of rock the boat too much. It was only when the skull of this dinosaur was discovered in the late 1970s that the big image change to Apatosaurus happened. But even then, when I went to the American Museum of Natural History in 1988, I saw the Brontosaurus skeleton. Even though it had been scientifically extinct for, 8 decades by then. So to me, it was the perfect totem or emblem to use to then show, okay, well, what have we learned since then? Why are the dinosaurs that I'm seeing now in film and art and books and magazines so different from the ones that I initially grew up with, as a way to talk about the science, how science is constantly changing, how we're pulling more than ever before out of dinosaur bones. You know, paleontology isn't a matter of just finding fossils and digging them up and putting them in a museum. That's really only the very beginning of unraveling this great story of evolution and the history of life on Earth.
Could you name for us just some of the species, the unsung species that have helped paleontologists understand the ancient world?
Yeah, one of the first ones is from my former home state of New Jersey. It's a dinosaur called Hadrosaurus. It's one of these shovel-beaked herbivorous dinosaurs that lived relatively late in the Cretaceous. And it was the first dinosaur to be known from a relatively good partial skeleton. All the previous discoveries were either confused for other animals, or they were just, you know, bits of jaw and bits of leg and things like that. So they couldn't really get a good conception of what the whole animal was like. This was one of the first ones to show that dinosaurs carried their legs directly beneath their bodies, that in some of them their forelimbs were shorter than their hind limbs, so they had to walk, you know, on two legs most of the time. It kind of redefined the image of what a dinosaur was from a gigantic lizard, which is how they were first envisioned, into something that was kind of unique and had never been seen before. Following that, in the 1960s, in 1969, one of the most important dinosaurs ever found is called Deinonychus. It stood about as tall as, you know, the average height human. It had these switchblade claws on its feet. And when it was discovered, this was during the time when dinosaurs were thought to be slow and sluggish and stupid and swamp-bound, it really challenged that image. Just looking at its skeleton with those grasping hands and those sharp teeth and the switchblade claws and this long tail as a counterbalance, it had to be an active and dynamic animal. And it was found in a quarry with multiple specimens of Deinonychus and one of an herbivore, and it brought up the prospect, well, maybe these things were hunting as a group to bring this herbivore down when they died. So, you know, just in this one dinosaur really challenged the image of what a dinosaur was, sparked the dinosaur renaissance that I mentioned earlier. And then one of the latest discoveries in 1996, tied to that, I mean, Deinonychus, it wasn't only very active, but it also was very, very bird-like. It looked like the earliest known fossil bird called Archaeopteryx, brought up the prospect that maybe birds are dinosaurs. And the piece of evidence that really opened the floodgates for sort of proving that to be true was a really tiny dinosaur about the size of a chicken called Sinosauropteryx. It was found in China. Has filamentous feathers running all the way down its back. And this was the first definite non-avian dinosaur to be found with these kinds of feathers and really tied together and really confirmed the idea that birds are living dinosaurs, that many of the features that we think of being sort of unique to birds today actually have a very, very deep evolutionary history. So I don't think Sinosauropteryx is going to be a household word anytime soon, but it's one of the most important dinosaurs ever found. It dramatically changed our image of what it was to be a dinosaur.
Well, we obviously can't go through all 500 genera that have been named, but what would it take for us to have a more accurate or more complete spectrum in the future?
That's a really good question. I think it really comes down to science communication and how we, you know, get across new discoveries, that there aren't just this one-shot find of, okay, there's a new tyrannosaur or there's a new horned dinosaur or something like that, but there's information that's really coming through. And I think one of the best ways that we might be able to do it is actually by partnering with Hollywood. I mean, Jurassic Park 4, Jurassic World was just announced not so long ago, coming out next summer. I think if the movie creators and the special effects artists could pick some lesser-known dinosaurs, could pick some animals that haven't had their time in the spotlight, really bring them to life as best we can, you know, really to get the closest that we're really ever going to get to seeing a living non-avian dinosaur, I think that we can really introduce the public to sort of the greater variety of these dinosaurs and, you know, really sort of highlight some of these animals descended from dinosaurs like Velociraptor, but had pot bellies and Freddy Krueger claws covered in feathers and these little beaky heads. It's, you know, nothing like I've never seen anything like that on screen before. I think it would really shock audiences. So that's my plea to the creators of Jurassic Park 4 is pick out some of these lesser known weirdos and give them some time in the spotlight.
All right, wait till Hasbro gets a hold of them. Brian Sweetek, author of My Beloved Brontosaurus. It's a book about the history of paleontology. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Here's a fun fact. The first evidence of dinosaur urine wasn't discovered until 2002, and it turns out that paleontologists are still trying to unravel the mysteries of dino bladders. One thing's for certain, they were probably very big. Beer-soaked college students, not so much. NHPR environmental reporter Sam Evans-Brown brings us this story from UNH.
Ah, the sounds of college late on a Friday night. You can practically hear the bladders filling.
Do you guys want to donate your urine to be used as fertilizer?
Hell yeah! Where do I go?
Allison Packham, one of four seniors who took on what came to be known as the P-Bus Project, recruits donors from a stream of partygoers walking from Stoke Hall towards some off-campus housing.
Originally, the idea was, let's get one of those big buses, and we can just have little stalls in them. But buses were too expensive. We got this trailer for free from the Durham Public Works Department.
The P-Bus is really more like a P-Wagon, as it's basically a shed mounted on a trailer with urinals cut out of 5-gallon buckets. Whatever we call it, it clearly works for well-hydrated freshman John Chiburi.
And, like, donating urine is the best thing you could do, because it's the easiest thing you could do, and if it's for something, it's good.
The idea all started with Dave Cederholm, head of Durham's Department of Public Works. He was going over some monitoring data from the town's wastewater treatment plant.
And we happened to notice between like 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning, there's this dramatic spike in nitrogen actually coming into the plant. And we also, we saw similar spikes like that during hockey games and basketball games and that sort of thing. And it's pretty obvious where that, you know, what that source is.
The wastewater plant works best with a steady, even flow. So these big spikes in led to big spikes out. And too much nitrogen can lead to a whole host of problems in ecosystems, especially once it hits the Great Bay Estuary, where salt and freshwater mix.
I am following you on the Twitter because this is on the point.
On the first night, a Thursday, there were already takers, netting the P-Bus 7 gallons.
We had 55, not necessarily people peeing, but 55 pee occurrences, I guess.
As in, there were some repeat users. And Taylor Walter, who was the first student on board with the project, and Allison Packham, say those pioneers were adventurous in more ways than one.
Guys can go anywhere we find, and the girls, there's been, how many girls were there last night?
I'd say at least a dozen.
It's a dozen girls who were brave and wanted to just, like, test it out and try it out. And
It's a little unconventional because it's supposed to be a urinal. But, I mean, there's a way to finagle women to pee into it.
200 people availed themselves of the P-Bus on the first weekend. The 25 gallons gathered will go to two local farmers.
It's an extraordinarily biologically available, nutrient-rich fertilizer.
One of them, Dorn Cox from Lee, grows grains and is a PhD candidate at UNH. A scientist farmer.
80-90% of the nutrients are actually in the urine portion of animal manures. That's the real concentrated fertilizer. And it's the rest of the manure that generally has more of the concerns for application.
So that problem of E. coli-tainted spinach starts because farmers spread solid waste just trying to get at the urine that could be separated out from the beginning. Using human urine has already been tested in Brattleboro, Vermont, where a hay field that was treated with 1,000 gallons per acre of pasteurized urine grew at about the same rate as one treated with synthetic fertilizer. Which begs a question for the P-Bus enterprise. At 25 gallons a weekend, we're not talking about a lot of fertilizer. And the students working on this project, like Adam Kerrigan, know it.
I guess we're here kind of to educate people as to why we're doing this.
Could you imagine a world in which, you know, there's one of these on every corner?
You know, I'm not sure if this is the way to go on a large scale, but, you know, the concepts, the whole idea of using the urine as a fertilizer is definitely doable.
But making it work commercially is something that would take more than a few beers to work out.
Make water flow uphill.
For NHPR News, I'm Sam Evans-Brown.
We gotta fix this problem. This parking lot's a big, giant frosty. It is, look at it. This parking lot's just like a desert of lumps.
Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. We hope you'll share yours. I'm Virginia Prescott, heading out for the day to Landmark College in Putney, Vermont, where I'll be working with students today and tomorrow, and tonight giving a talk at the Next Stages Theater in Putney. If you'd like more information, you'll find it at wordofmouthradio.org.
Taylor Quimby will be filling in tomorrow with a very prank-heavy show for April Fool's Day. That's on Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.